So I'm going to tell you about a system that we've built that helps recover from intrusions on computer systems. So despite our best efforts to build secure computer systems, we inevitably continue seeing compromises of integrity of our computers. So probably last year you've heard about this attack on Google servers where adversaries were able to break into Google's development systems. And closer to home for us, some students at a nearby university were able to compromise the grades database and modify the grades of their own classes and other students. And even on your own desktop computers, you've probably seen messages like these when your virus scanner detects that your machine has been compromised by some virus or piece of malware. So what I want to argue here is that these kinds of compromises are inevitable for our computer systems. Not only is it, of course, difficult to write bug-free software in the first place that prevents these compromises, but also administrators will inevitably sometimes misconfigure security policies that allow these attacks to happen, and users themselves might choose weak passwords that can be easily guessed by an adversary. So what I want to argue is that, in fact, we need both the proactive security mechanisms that we have today that try to prevent compromises in the first place, and also we need to focus on some more principled approaches to reactive recovery mechanisms that we might be able to invoke once these inevitable compromises happen. So today, what you do to recover from an attack is use one of two basically existing recovery classes of tools. One is antivirus tools, which are good for repairing from predictable attacks, like a small set of viruses and malware that's been analyzed by the antivirus vendor. And there's also backup tools that administrators might use to recover wholesale from a previous backup of your system. Now, this, of course, discards the entire attack, but it also happens to discard all the other legitimate work that users have been doing since the time the attack took place. Now, because neither of these two technologies is particularly satisfactory, what administrators usually end up doing is spending days or weeks having to manually track down and repair all of the effects of an intrusion on a computer system. And even after they spend all this time, there is no real guarantee that they've found all the effects and all the back doors that an attacker might have left on your computer. So the reason this is so difficult is because these administrators are having to disentangle the changes by an attacker and by legitimate users on the same computer. And of course, the adversary could have modified many files directly if they have access to your system. But what makes this even more difficult is that other legitimate processes might have been affected by these changes. For example, legitimate users might have ran Trojan PDF LaTeX or LS binaries that the attacker modified, or the SSH server read a password file that was modified by the attacker. And at this point, all of these other processes are now suspect as well, because, for example, any SSH login now is potentially a login by the adversary into our computer. So in this work, we're going to propose to help users disentangle these changes by the adversary and by legitimate users on a single machine. And in order to do this, we're going to record a history of all computations that happen on this machine. And then once an intrusion has been detected, we're going to roll back the objects directly affected by the attack and re-execute any actions that were indirectly affected, such as the Trojans I mentioned on the previous slide. Of course, we're not going to be able to always disentangle attacker and legitimate changes automatically. For example, if the user went ahead and manually found the attacker's files and edited them with Emacs, we're going to have to ask the user, you know, what would you have done if the attacker's files weren't there? But we'd like to ideally minimize the amount of user input necessary in order to disentangle these changes with our system. So in particular, the contributions of our work are, first of all, a new approach that we're proposing to performing intrusion recovery on a system-wide scale that's based around this data structure called an action history graph that I'll describe to you in a little bit. And this action history graph is going to track all the computations in our system. And we use several techniques on this action history graph to repair from intrusions, one of which I already mentioned, this idea of re-execution, and two more ideas of predicates and refinement that I'll describe in a little bit that make re-execution practical. We've also implemented a prototype of this design for Linux in a system called Retro, which shows that our approach can actually recover from a mix of 10 real-world and synthetic attacks with no user input being required in most cases. So the high bit you should take away from this on contribution is really that With Retro, now the administrator can, instead of spending days or weeks on manual recovery, they can simply use Retro to automatically recover from an intrusion and actually ensure that they were able to catch all of the effects of the attack, as opposed to just the ones they might have been able to find manually. So to understand how we might recover from an intrusion, let's actually consider some example attack scenario. So here we have an attack where, at the top, the adversary breaks into your system and modifies the password file to add an account for themselves. And the adversary might also want to run a botnet, so they install a Trojan PDF LaTeX binary and a Trojan LS binary that's going to restart and hide their botnet process. Then the real administrator comes along and modifies the password file to add an account for legitimate user Alice. And finally, user Alice logs in via SSH, so the SSH server, of course, has to read the password file now. And Alice might run some of these Trojan commands like PDF LaTeX or LS. And for the purposes of this attack, let's assume that the attacker is not specifically targeting Alice here and simply wants to run a botnet on this computer system that they've compromised. So how can we recover from this attack? Well, one strawman approach I want to consider first is based on this idea that I'll call taint tracking. So the idea is we're going to consider the set of all processes and files on our computer system indicated by blue circles here. And we're going to record all the dependencies between these objects, such as a process reading or writing a file, indicated by arrows on this slide. So now, suppose that we detect that one of these processes was an attack process. We can use this recorded dependency information to track down all the objects and files that might have been possibly affected by the attack, such as these set of yellow objects, and then we can roll back all of these objects to an earlier checkpoint. This is, of course, going to get rid of the attack because we've reverted all the possible files that were affected. But the big problem with this approach is one of false positives. So suppose the attacker modifies some shared files like the PDF LaTeX binary or the password file. In this case, we're going to have to revert all the objects that depended on those files, which in our case includes the entire Alice's entire account and all the files she ever modified or created in the system. So I posit that this is an unacceptable cost of an intrusion recovery system. And I want to think about how can we do better. Well, one way we might be able to do better to preserve Alice's account is to try to re-execute these legitimate computations. So let's look at another straw man based around the idea of virtual machines that will try to re-execute legitimate actions. So here, consider our whole system as a virtual machine with time running down the slide. And we're going to look at all the inputs and outputs to and from this virtual machine. You can imagine these are network packets. And these black boxes represent periods of time when the virtual machine is executing some instructions. Now, we can periodically checkpoint this virtual machine, represented by these circles. And now, if we detect that one of the inputs to the virtual machine was an input from an attacker, we can try to roll back the virtual machine to an earlier checkpoint and re-execute from that point forward, skipping the attack input but preserving all the other inputs. So at some high level, you might imagine that this would give us a state where the attack is removed from the virtual machine, but all the legitimate computations are preserved. But unfortunately, this straw man suffers from two significant problems. One is that re-execution of the entire VM is very expensive. If we want to recover from an attack that took place a week ago, it might take us another week to re-execute the virtual machine with the good inputs. A more subtle problem with this straw man is that the original inputs to the virtual machine might be meaningless for the new system. Because we are re-executing things non-deterministically, our new system might have new cryptographic keys for SSH connections, new inode numbers, new application state, and the original input might simply not make sense. And unfortunately, we cannot do traditional deterministic re-execution techniques because we are fundamentally changing the inputs to this virtual machine, such as dropping the attack input, and expecting a different state in the end of the day. So how can we deal with this problem? Well, Retro's approach to this problem is to implement this technique of selective re-execution. So what Retro does is it records a fine-grained dependency graph, which we call an action history graph. It's similar to the dependency graph I showed you in the taint tracking strawman, but it's much more detailed and includes system call arguments, function calls, and so on. And here we're going to assume that we have a tamper-proof kernel and storage system to keep track of this action history graph. Then, once the attack is detected, we're going to roll back the objects that are directly affected by the attack. And this is going to avoid us the false positives of the taint tracking straw man. And then we're going to re-execute just the specific actions that were indirectly affected by the attack. And this is going to avoid the expense and non-determinism of re-executing the whole virtual machine. So let me show you what this looks like in our diagram. So here we have an example action history graph where we have objects representing the files and processes in our running example. And each process in this action history graph has a set of actions representing their execution. And each action has a set of dependencies, such as this action writing to the password file. Or we can have the administrator shell spawning the add user Alice process, and that process reading and writing the password file, and finally exiting back to the administrator shell. Now we can very much, like with the VM strawman, we can checkpoint these objects periodically. And now we're ready to actually try to recover from the intrusion here. So the first thing we have to do, of course, is to identify the attack action, which might be this action by the attacker process writing to the password file on the left. And once we've done so, we recover by rolling back the affected object, namely the password file, to an earlier checkpoint, and re-executing all the subsequent actions except for the attack action. So what we do here is we skip the attacker's write, but now we want to re-execute the read by the add user Alice process. And we do this in much the same way. We roll back the add user Alice process to an earlier checkpoint, and we re-execute all the actions on that object starting from the exec system call that started add user Alice in the first place. And this is our key advantage of the virtual machine strawman, which is that we can repair the password file by rerunning just the add user Alice process instead of having to rerun the entire virtual machine, which is expensive and non-deterministic. Now we can continue running the add user Alice process, allow it to write back out the Alice account to the password file, and finally exit back to the administrator shell. At this point, we're in a state that's better than either the virtual machine or the taint tracking strawman I presented to you earlier, which is that we've recovered the password file, we've removed the attack, but we've preserved the legitimate changes of the Alice user account, and we didn't have to rerun the entire virtual machine. And this is great, except that I've skipped over one important detail, which is that according to the rules I've described to you so far, we might have to now re-execute the administrator shell because the add user Alice process exited back to that, and we might need to propagate this effect. And then we might need to, as a result, re-execute SSHD and many other processes in our system. So what this means is that this naive approach to process-level re-execution is still going to lead to a re-execution of a large fraction of the overall system. So how can we solve this problem? Well, the observation we make in retro is that, in fact, many of these suspect computations are, in fact, not really affected by the attacker. For example, consider the case where the attacker adds one account to the password file. In this situation, Alice's SSH server does read the entire password file, but most likely it's only going to look up Alice's account in that password file, and it's going to ignore the attacker's account, as long as the attacker is not named Alice. And similarly, if the attacker adds one line to the PDF LaTeX shell script to restart the attacker's botnet, well, if Alice runs this PDF LaTeX shell script, it might restart the attacker's botnet, but otherwise it's going to still perform the same legitimate work it would have otherwise done. And the flip side of this argument is that, in fact, if there are significant changes to our system, like the entire password file being modified or the attacker removing PDF LaTeX, then we're going to be able to detect this attack much earlier, and we're not going to need many of this machinery that tries to disentangle attack and legitimate actions. So in particular, the approach we're going to take is we're going to try to minimize re-execution whenever possible using two ideas, the first of which is this idea of predicates, which allows retro to skip equivalent computations. So a predicate is going to check whether inputs to an action are the same before and after a pair, and if this is the case, then retro is going to assume that the original result of the computation was okay, and there is no need to re-execute it further. And the second idea of refinement allows retro to re-execute fine-grained actions instead of re-executing an entire process or login session. And this is going to be great for cases where only a small part of that computation was really affected by the attack. So to see what these ideas look like, let's go back to this example where the add user Alice process was exiting back to the administrator's shell. In this case, we can apply a predicate to the exit status dependency and check if the exit status is the same before and after a pair. In the common case, this is going to be zero in both cases, indicating add user Alice succeeded, and there's going to be no need to re-execute the administrator shell because it wasn't actually affected by the attack. Here's another example. So after we repair the password file here, it's going to be read by Alice's SSH server, which is now on the right of this slide. We might imagine that because Alice's SSH server reads this modified password file, we'll have to re-execute that whole process to repair it. But in fact, the only part of SSH that was really affected, on Unix at least, is this function called getPWName that, given a particular username, returns that user's password file entry. So retro explicitly represents such functions in this action history graph. And what this allows us to do is to re-execute just the getPWName function, and then we can use a predicate to check if the return value of getPWName, namely Alice's account, is still the same. And if it is, as in our running example, then there's no need to further re-execute Alice's SSH server. Now, there's one detail I haven't mentioned yet, which is what happens if the attack was actually externally visible on our system. Namely, what happens if the attacker actually sends spam from our computer, or if the user saw the wrong output from the ls command? Well, of course, in the general case, we're not going to be able to address this problem fully because the spam has already been sent, and we might actually have to pause during repair and ask for user input for how to deal with this conflict. But we can actually perform compensating actions in certain situations. For example, for Unix terminal sessions, we can actually compute the output from the terminal both before and after repair, compute the diff between these two outputs, and email that to the user. So what's going on in this case is that presumably the user should not have seen that attack.c file in the output of the ls command, but they should have seen the four files at the bottom of the slide that the attacker presumably removed. All right, so this is the design of our system. Now I want to mention a little bit about the implementation of retro. This is an overall architecture of our implementation. One thing to note is that our implementation is reasonably small, consisting of about 4,000 lines of code on the right side of the slide in the kernel module in libc, and about 5,000 lines of Python code for the repair management system. Another interesting thing to note is that we reuse existing checkpointing file systems, such as BTRFS, to make periodic snapshots of our files. And one change we make to that is that we actually preserve inode numbers during repair by only reusing an inode once it's free in every single snapshot, as opposed to just the current file system. We also use ptrace to shepherd the re-execution of processes, which allows us to detect and skip equivalent system calls during repair, such as an exec system call that is executing an identical child process during repair, which we can then skip. And finally, we partition the repair logic between a simple repair controller and a set of repair managers you see towards the right of that, with a well-defined API between them, including operations I've described to you already, such as rollback of objects, redoing actions, and checking predicates on an action. So in order to evaluate our prototype, we wanted to answer two high-level questions. First of all, how much better is it to use retro than to perform manual repair of your computer system? And the second is, what is the cost of using retro during normal execution? So to answer the first question, we collected a set of 10 different attacks. Two of these guys came from a honeypot that we set up, which included attacks that removed log entries, added accounts for the attacker, and so on. We also constructed two synthetic challenge attacks that we thought would be particularly challenging for this retro system, including the running example I mentioned to you already, where we have a Trojan PDF LaTeX binary and so on, and also a worst-case scenario we could imagine, which is a compromised SSHD binary that the attacker replaces with a Trojan. And finally, we used a set of 6 attacks from a previous system called Taser that was published several years ago that includes a fairly extensive set of workloads, such as a file sharing service, a database server, and so on, with a wide range of modifications being made by attackers. So the result of our evaluation was that for these 10 attacks, retro is able to recover and repair from all 10 of them. The sort of next level bit is that in 6 out of these 10 cases, retro required no user input to repair from this attack. So what this means is our automatic re-execution mechanism was working well. We're able to re-execute these Trojan binaries. We're able to re-execute database queries and so on. And there's no need for user input, although we sometimes generate a terminal diff when the user output should have changed. In 2 more out of these 10 cases, some small amount of user input was needed to skip attackers' logins via SSH. So what's going on in these 2 scenarios is that the administrator detected the attack and traced it back to the initial packet that compromised the server and perhaps added the attacker's account, but the administrator didn't notice the subsequent login sessions via SSH by the attacker. So in this case, retro repaired the system and tried to replay the subsequent login sessions, but of course they wouldn't replay because the attacker's account is not there anymore. So in this case, retro required some user input to indicate that it's okay to skip these subsequent login sessions. And finally, in two more cases, we actually required, or retro actually required, significant amount of user input to deal with legitimate network I/O that a compromised process had to perform. So for example, in the Trojan SSH server example, retro was unable to replay the original SSH packets because the cryptographic keys have changed. And in this case, retro might not be able to automatically repair the system, but we believe it's still better than a manual repair approach because retro can pinpoint the specific files and objects that the administrator has to focus on and inspect for repair manually. So we also wanted to evaluate the cost of repairing a system using retro. So we focused on the first four of these attacks you see on this slide and measured the number of objects that retro had to repair to recover from these attacks. So the things to note here is that retro actually repairs, in many cases, only a small number of objects in the system. And more generally, what you should note is that the repair cost here is really proportional to the extent of the attack. So for example, in the Trojan SSH server example, the attacker actually did influence the bulk of the system. And in that case, retro did have to touch most of the objects in the system. But in other cases, retro only touched a small fraction of the total action history graph size. Moreover, the time that retro actually takes to repair from these attacks is largely proportional to the number of objects being repaired and not the overall size of the log or the workload being considered. So what you see on this slide is the time we measure to repair from a fairly simple attack, which consists of about 100 objects and 400 system calls. And if the only thing in the action history graph is this specific attack and nothing else, then repair takes 0.3 seconds, so it's reasonably fast. And if in addition to that, we add a much larger workload, such as a kernel compile, to the action history graph and make the action history graph consist of about 6 million system calls, the repair time now takes about 5 seconds. So the thing to take away from this is that even though we're increasing the size of the action history graph, the workload, by a factor of about 10,000 times, the repair time only goes up by a factor of 10. Which indicates that the graph size itself is not going to be a significant, it's not going to have a significant impact on the time it takes to repair from an intrusion. It's mostly the number of objects we have to repair. And this is really the point that we, the goal of retro's design, which is that we want it to be much more efficient than re-executing all the computations on our system like an entire virtual machine. So we also wanted to measure the overhead of running retro during normal execution when we're not repairing from attacks. So to do so, we ran the HotCRP conference management software using the workload from a couple of hours before the SOSP 2007 deadline. And the CPU overhead for that was about 35%. And retro required about 4 gigabytes per day of log storage to store the snapshots and the action history graph. So we think this is a reasonable overhead for an application like this. But we also wanted to measure the overhead of retro for more intensive applications. And for this, we used an Apache web server that was spending 100% of its CPU time serving small static files, and also a continuous kernel recompile workload where we would run make and make clean in a tight loop. So for these more extreme workloads, sort of the worst case for retro, the CPU cost is about 2x, and the storage overhead is close to 100 gigabytes per day. So the good news is that even for this extreme workload, we're still able to store about 2 weeks' worth of logs on a fairly cheap 2 terabyte disk. Another piece of good news is that this overhead is easy to parallelize. So if there's a second core in our system that the application itself is not using, then we can easily use the second core to greatly reduce the CPU overhead of retro's logging in the common case. So there are several important pieces of related work I want to mention. There is, of course, the work on having to track down the intrusion in the first place to an initial set of attack actions, such as the backtracker and introvert systems. And retro relies on these systems to pinpoint the initial source of the attack. There's also related work on using approaches similar to the taint tracking strawman I presented to you earlier to try to find and revert the affected files, such as the Taser system that does this on a single machine and the Polygraph system that works in a distributed setting. Unfortunately, these approaches are prone to false positives, as I mentioned to you earlier. Finally, the only other system that actually performs a significant amount of selectively allowing users to undo actions from the past and re-executing legitimate actions on top of that is the undoable email store by Aaron Brown. And the difference from Retro is that Brown's system can only fix administrative configuration errors effectively in a single application, namely the mail server, whereas Retro can deal with an adversarial setting and perform repair on a system-wide scale. So in conclusion, I hope I've convinced you that recovering from attacks and preserving legitimate user changes at the same time is a hard and important problem, and I've presented to you a system called Retro that tries to do so by repairing from attacks and keeping legitimate changes using this idea of re-execution of legitimate actions. And in order to make this idea of re-execution practical, we use two ideas of predicates and refinement to minimize the amount of re-execution we have to do at repair time. Thanks very much, and I'd be happy to take your questions.
Peter Chen, University of Michigan. Nice talk. I really like this work. It seems like an important problem and really challenging. And it seems to me that a key challenge is how do you pick the level at which you're recording actions and trying to re-execute them? So if you go really low level, then it seems like at the extreme would be the VM, I suppose, then you're going to have a hard time because it's very fragile. It's going to be very subject to change due to not undoing some or not replaying some prior actions. So my question is, it seems like your actions are at the level of system calls. Mm-hmm. Is that correct? Okay.
So we have both system calls and function calls and some other things that I haven't yet. Sure.
Okay. So I guess my first question would be, how did you pick that level? And my second related would be, did you experience any cases where it was very fragile to small changes in the replay? For example, not replaying, not adding the bad user, the attacker's user would affect future behavior of the login script in terms of which offsets it would read from mm-hmm. the password file, for example.
Sure. So we picked the system call level for the big reason that it's actually complete, that we can guarantee that we must see the attack at this level because it captures all the dependencies in the system. But we actually reintroduced these higher level managers effectively that I mentioned to you, like tracking get PW name and so on, specifically in response to this sort of false dependencies like the offsets and the password file mattering so we could replay individual functions. And the nice thing is that, as I mentioned in this overall system architecture slide, this interface between the repair controller and the managers is actually a fairly narrow and well-defined interface that makes it easy to introduce new managers into the system without having to change the rest, the overall design. So we can easily add new functions, new layers in the system without having to compromise the completeness of the system call level, for example, and so on.
Thank you.
Josh Triplett, Portland State University. I was wondering, the storage and CPU requirements you described seem fairly high if you're not in a situation where you really have to deal with this situation regularly, but at the same time, they seem like they're within, you know, an order of magnitude or so of something that would just get lost in the noise, and of course you should have this turned on because why wouldn't you? And so I'm wondering, do you have any thoughts on whether it'd be possible to tune the system to say, okay, I'm going to record a little bit less precise information in the graph and track a little bit less of what's on the system, and in exchange it will be a little harder to recover, or I might have a little more chance of losing legitimate user actions, but at the same time I pay a much lower cost.
Absolutely. I think there's two kinds of trade-offs you can make. One is you can trade off the amount of legitimate user actions you can preserve, which is that you don't log as much and you only log things you really want to replay, or you might say that certain things are not going to get compromised, you make that assumption, and you don't log things relating to that part of the graph. The other trade-off you can make is you can actually trade off the logging cost for repair time. So if you log fewer things during normal execution, you might have to reconstruct more of the dependency graph, this action history graph, at repair time by re-executing things that didn't have to be re-executed, but you can re-execute them at repair time, construct the fine-grained action history graph then, and then you can proceed with repair at that point. So there's, I think, lots of optimizations you could do to significantly reduce this overhead. We haven't had the time to do that yet. Yes.
So in general, if you're willing to say that I don't expect a break-in, but I'd like the ability to recover, even though I don't mind if it's going to take me a while of my time to recover my personal system, then you can trade off not having to have a huge number of resources logging.
I believe that's the case. We haven't implemented that precisely, but it seems like one optimization we want to try, yes.
Thanks.
Margo Seltzer from Harvard University. So it sounds like your action history graphs are exactly what we've been capturing in PaaS's provenance for several years. So I'm wondering if you've actually figured out how to solve a couple of the hard problems. So what do you do about non-deterministic programs and negative information flow?
So luckily for us, that turns out not to be a significant problem for the following reason, which is that all we care about is we want to get some acceptable execution that wasn't affected by the attacker. So in fact, it might be okay that we end up with a slightly different execution for reasons other than the attack being removed. We try to, of course, minimize this by minimizing re-execution using predicates and this refinement idea.
So but my data can get changed arbitrarily on the file system because you've replayed something?
Yes, so that's a potential risk of this, which is that we might decide that it has to be re-executed just to verify it wasn't affected by the attack. It also happens that the program you used to generate this data was non-deterministic, and it could have produced either result in the first place. So the only guarantee we can really provide is we're going to give you an acceptable execution, not necessarily the same execution, because we fundamentally do want to change something about our system state. And we think our minimization of re-execution helps quite a bit. We haven't really seen significant cases of this, but it is possible, yes.
And what do you do about negative information flow?
So what do you mean, like a file being missing from a directory?
No, so for example, in your example, I guess it would be that after the attacker has hit, I have a program that for some reason counts the number of lines in the password file, and if it's odd, I do something.
Oh, sure,
and if it's
yes.
even, so, I don't.
So we'll certainly record the dependency on the password file, and we're going to, if it read the whole password file, we're going to re-execute it. So if it produces then a different output, we'll continue re-executing until we converge to the state we had before.
But how do you? But it seems that at some points you're going to function call granularity, and if you go to function call
we only instrument certain function calls in libc, like get pw name, like get groups, and a couple of other things that we know the semantics of very well. Mm-hmm. And for general applications that we don't know, we don't instrument functions there.
Thanks. Pascal Kirk from CEA. So suppose that retro became ubiquitous so that the attacker could assume that it will be there. Could it become a goal for the attacker to produce many false positives? How easy would that be?
I think the attacker could do so. So for example, we had this extreme sort of worst case for us, the compromised SSHD, which means that potentially everything in your system that was done through SSH connection is now suspect because the attacker could have replaced your keystrokes with anything. So we believe it's possible. Our sort of hope that we haven't really verified yet experimentally is that this will make the attack much easier to detect in the action history graph, because you can look for cases where an attack is now affecting your entire system or some highly shared files have been compromised. Basically, our hope is that this makes the attack much easier to find if it affects the system on such a large scale. But we haven't, sort of experimentally verified this.
Hi, Lorenzo Cavallaro, Freie Universität Amsterdam. I was wondering if you guys performed any evaluation on throughput and latency, for instance, for web workloads. And another question, if there are any protection, so if you guys protect retro in any way from attackers that target retro, like modify the kernel code or the other front end. And the last question, is about, so given the fact that nowadays attackers tend to target client machines, specifically Windows machines, how hard would it be to adapt retro to a Windows machine that is, you know, closed source, and the user interaction with the system might be, you know, flexible and eclectic or, you know, a lot complex than what you showed here?
Right, so we think... Right, so I believe for Windows machines, you would have to write several more managers probably to deal with shared services like LSAS or Win32 APIs on Windows, very much like we did for Unix here. So I think the ideas are fundamentally, we believe, are applicable to Windows, but we haven't figured out which specific managers or functions we'd need to instrument. In terms of protecting the system from being compromised, we use things like SE Linux to protect the kernel and the retro subsystem from being tampered, even if the attacker gets root access. But as I mentioned, we do actually assume that the kernel is intact. We do imagine that we might be able to use a virtual machine monitor to try to monitor things from the outside, but this has been done in previous systems like Backtracker and so on, but we haven't had the time
okay,
to port this.
What about the libc wrappers?
Right, so we would have to be, it's not trivial, so we'd have to be fairly careful about the assumptions we make about what we can trust inside the virtual machine. We think it can be done to some extent, but I don't want to claim that we've done it.
The throughput and latency, just
need,
just a word.
We need to move on, sorry.
All right. Take
the rest
offline. Thanks.
Thanks.
Let's thank our speaker again.